And basically, the outline is that at the time that God punishes the wicked, there are three groups that will relate to God's action of punishing the wicked. Okay? That's the general outline. Anyway, it goes like this. It says that when God will reign, the earth will rejoice, and the islands of civilization will be happy. Okay, so the first group is all civilized people, okay, the whole world. It says clouds and dark clouds will surround them. That'll be the evil people. They'll be surrounded in darkness. In other words, a metaphor for doom and doom and gloom for the wicked. Then tzedek u'mishpat, righteousness and justice, will be the foundation of God's throne. Okay? In other words, the world will recognize that he is the true king of the world. And then it describes, either literally or in metaphors, the destruction. A fire will come out before him, and it will go, and it will burn all his enemies around. His enemies mean the evil people that are against justice. Lightning will light up the world, and the people will see, and or the nations will see, and they will, and the earth will tremble. All right. Then it says the mountains will melt like wax before God. Before the master of all the earth. Okay, now the question is, what is the mountain? Okay, and many commentaries want to say the mountain is the haughty. Right? The haughty people, the leaders that feel haughty, okay? Right, so the question is, what is haughty in this context? Okay, the question is, what is the haughty person? That's the first question. And the second question, he uses a metaphor that'll melt, that they'll melt like wax. Now, what is the meaning of the metaphor, and what is the metaphor teaching us? Right, so the definition of haughty is a person that does not accept reality. Okay, haughty is where I do not accept the reality. Haughty means where what I feel or what I think is right, and I don't take in consideration reality around me, that is a haughty. So when it says mountains which you have to look up to it at its high, that's the haughty. Those are the people that think they're above reality. Yes. And of course there are two realities that we deal with. One reality is the laws of nature. Sometimes the evil people go out of even the laws of nature. They become so haughty that they don't take into consideration certain realities, and they do things and they get destroyed simply because they go against the laws of nature. Okay? Then there's a certain haughtiness that they don't take into consideration the abstract idea of God, which you can't see in the physical world, and they don't want to see this. They don't want to see God because that would take away from my greatness. You understand? My invincibility, my dependence on myself. I'd have to depend on the God. So because of those emotions, they refuse to see the true God, even though it's not a difficult thing to see the true God. Okay? All right. Now the question is, so when God will punish them, when God punishes the wicked, you see, so then it says they'll melt like wax. Okay? Question is, what is the metaphor saying? Let me ask a further question here. In other words, it relates them to mountains, and then when they're going to be destroyed, they're going to melt like wax. Okay? So the question is, what are the metaphors, what are both metaphors telling us? Right, so God wants to explain it like this, that a mountain, to a certain extent, if you notice, the newer mountains are very sharp. They're older, they're a few million years older, they're rounder. Like the Olympics are sharp, sharper tips, the Olympics, Well, the Cascades is rounder, because the Cascades is a few million years older than the Olympics, you see. So the thing is that it erodes slowly, okay? So the same thing with the evil person, he doesn't notice it, but he starts taking steps that it starts to destroy him. The laws of nature will bring him down after a certain amount of time. It could be years. It could be the next generation. Sometimes you see consequences in terms of generations. Each generation gets worse. So the thing is, in the laws of nature, the destruction or the consequences come in a very slow process. But when God intervenes, you see, when God is going to punish the wicked, you see, it'll be so noticeable, the weakness and the consequences of the wicked, that it'll be like wax melting, you see. So when God intervenes in the laws of nature, the destruction will be quick, very quick, like wax melting, not like a mountain becoming slowly destroyed. A lot of people don't notice the, in other words, the all the steps of the consequence in the laws of nature. They might suddenly see that the person is destroyed, you see. But really, if you look back, you'll see most of the times it's a slow process of doing incorrect acts. But you have a certain emotion that keeps driving you in the wrong direction. After a while, it destroys you. But it's not very quick. It just looks quick because you don't notice it, you see. But however, when God intervenes, people will definitely know that God is intervening, because they'll see the quickness of the destruction of evil. That's one of the ways of recognizing that when something is under God's hashkacha, when the evil person, it's not a natural, you can't attach it to a slow process, but it's a very quick process where God will intervene in the laws of nature. In other words, when God intervenes, it must be recognizable. You don't have to work through difficulty where God is punishing, a certain type of punishment where God intervenes. Where God intervenes, it'll be noticeable by everybody because of the quickness of the destruction when God punishes at certain times. All right, that was verse 5. Verse 6 is the heavens will tell his righteousness. By that it means that the God will punish them through the heavens or whatever, however, will cause their downfall. So the heavens will tell his righteousness. And all the nations will see his honor, his glory. They will see God's glory. The obvious. A lot of people say this chapter is about the time of Messiah, when the Messiah will come. But it could be about Egypt too. It could be other times where God intervened, where it was very obvious that God was involved. Now what's going to happen is those that serve images will be embarrassed that they praise themselves through their nothingness. Elilim, the term for idols, comes from the word nothing. Al means nothing. So in their nothingness. Now they, in their own mind, they think these idols are very powerful things and could help them. You see? Here it will be totally obvious to them that all their idols are worthless. They'll really see that the idols are absolutely nothing when God will intervene and punish the world, the evil people. All their gods will bow down to him. The commentaries say that what it means, the gods will bow down, because they worship the skies and the different and even trees and different things in nature. They worship different things in nature. Now God at this time will use nature to destroy the enemy. So nature really bows down to God, gives into God's wishes. And they made these things into a god. You see, and God is going to use the very thing that what they use for God, he'll use that to destroy them. This, up until the end of 7, is how the nations of the world will see when God punishes the wicked. Zion will hear and be happy. The daughters of Judah will rejoice because of your judgment, God, because you are God above or exalted on all the earth. You are greatly exalted on all other gods. So the Jews that accepted God, they will recognize, they'll be very clear to them. In other words, the Jews, they accept God. But however, their acceptance of God is not complete. In other words, there's something missing. It's not a total reality. They accept, and yet there's a part of them that doesn't accept. They're in conflict in their acceptance of God. When God, so they don't deal with idols. They're not dealing with false gods. They're dealing with the real God, but their trust in the real God is not complete. So therefore, at this time, what's going to happen is going to, the Jews will recognize God's greatness. Okay, they'll really see without a doubt, there'll be no conflict that God is the true God. That is the way Israel will relate to when God punishes the evil. Okay? Then the last group is those that love God, they hate evil. And it's not only talking about then, it's talking about all times, even when God doesn't destroy the evil, even when evil is successful. They say that no, that God, they hate evil. They say evil is wrong. And God protects the lives of his chassidah, those other people on very high level. From the hand of the wicked, he saves them, and they see God operating even where it's not open and obvious that God is giving justice to the wicked. And then it says, verse 11 says that they'll plant light for the righteous and to the, in other words, that they will always have the light. It'll always be clear to them, the idea, like, Chovas Avavas talks about if a person is in a dark room that he never was in, he'll bunk into furniture. He'll keep banging himself. He says if he puts on a flashlight, so he'll see where the light is. He'll see where the objects is to walk around. So he says the Torah is the light. There are many, many objects in the physical world that constantly trip us up because we don't notice it. See, the righteous notice. They will have the light of the Torah, and they will see the truth around them, and they will not falter. And the Yishrei Lev, that's the just of heart or upright of heart, will be happiness. Okay, but what will their happiness consist of? That's verse 12. It says, and the righteous will be happy with Hashem. See, in other words, it's their knowledge of God. It's not that they have to see God do it. They don't have to wait for God to punish the wicked. They know that there is justice. You see? That is the righteous. The public accepts God. You know, yeah, God is good and God will help me. But there's a doubt. The righteous that study Torah and see the true view of God, so they're happy with God. And they always acknowledge and remember his holy name. Okay? So that is the three groups. So there's one group that they are the idolaters. They didn't accept the God of Israel. And they will see that everything they lived for and everything they praised themselves for, whatever they gloried in, whether it's idolatry or wealth or whatever they glory themselves in, they'll see it's absolutely nothing when God punishes the wicked. They'll see justice operating. They will see there's a God. Israel that relates to God, but there's a certain insecurity. It's not 100% that they accept. So they will be happy that they accepted God, but it'll take away their conflict, any conflict that they had with God. And for the righteous, there'll be very little new. Won't be any. They'll just be happy that God is recognized throughout the world and God's name is glorified throughout the world, but they accepted God in reality even when the wicked people are the strongest and all powerful, they will still recognize God's justice, and they'll understand why God is doing this. They'll understand all of God's justice and know why God is just and good, even when bad things are happening to them. It will not bother them because they'll relate to God. In other words, like for instance, the great people that died for God, like Rabbi Akiva, he was happy. He was happy. He saw the truth, and that's all that mattered to him. You see, he saw the truth. So that's all that mattered to him, was his relationship to God, even though evil was destroying him. But he accepted God 100%. There was no doubt at all that there was a God, and God was the right God. There was no doubt. You see, that is the last group. We are doing Mishlei, chapter 1, verse 10 to verse 19 inclusive, okay? And, okay, if you want, just read it in the English, and then we'll start from there. Okay, what are the questions? The first question is, it doesn't say, the translation is slightly wrong, does not say sinners. The Hebrew word is sins. The sins come to entice you. That's the first question. The second question is that if I wanted to entice you to do evil, I would have done it just the opposite of the way he did it. Over here they start, says, come let us kill people, right? That was the first thing. Then we'll take their precious wealth. We'll take all their wealth. We'll rob them, and then we'll cast our lot together. We'll be like a united group, and we'll share all our whatever we get. We'll share. In other words, the truth is, it should be just the opposite. In other words, if you want to entice somebody, you say, hey, we all work together, we're a group, we're a unit, and then we'll get money, we'll steal, and we'll be able to share it together, we'll be one. And if we get in trouble, we'll kill somebody. You know what I mean? If I want to entice somebody. And two, that would be, and the way he's describing it, it sounds like one person is enticing another. And yet he says sins. Does not say sinners. He says sins. If sins will entice you. So the question is, what is he talking about? That's the question. And I think what King Solomon is saying, that the basic part of the human being, the basic component of the human being, is antisocial. That he really does not care about anybody else. He's saying that's the nature of the human being. Okay. But however, I hear what you're saying. Okay, one second. But however, what happens is that people cover it up. You see, why do I need camaraderie? Because that's already the conscience covering the evil within me. The evil with everybody is basically evil. That's what it says in Torah, Pera Adam Yulad, a person is born wild. What does it mean? I don't see people born wild. I mean, you're not animals. But the fact is that the basic part of the unconscious, the basic part of that part of you that you're not aware of, is antisocial. You just simply don't care about another person. Other people don't count. But however you cover it up with your conscience, so you have a social type of, you have the social, that's the top part, that I'm social. That's why they say, let's get together and we'll rob people, we'll be all together. It's the top part, it's the superficial part that people are willing to accept. That's the part they're willing to accept that could be dangerous. But however, the basic foundation of the human being, according to King Solomon, is evil, and therefore they do not care about other people. Students want to say that it's not antisocial, the term antisocial, but it's egocentric. Okay, that's fine too. I accept that. I think because of this idea also, the reason for that people social, not all people, I can't say all people, but I think a lot of people socialize, it's because they're afraid to be alone. The need for social in people, I can't say all people again, but then for most people, from what I can notice, is they're afraid to be alone. Because if they're afraid to be, if they're alone, then their mind will start wandering about these things, about the very thing they're afraid to face, about their antisocial or egocentric part of them, where they don't care about other human beings, you see? So that feeling that people are very afraid of, so they have a social life to counteract that, which is the last thing that he mentions, you see? Last thing he mentions is the top part, which you see, you need friendship, and that's how they really entice you. They might say, look, we'll all be friends, we'll be together, we'll share, we'll all be equal. Of course, they don't mean that. That's only to entice, you see. That is the real way to entice. Then you get the desire, namely money. Then after the money, then if you have to kill, you kill. Then you bring out you reach that point where you could bring out that part of you which you were afraid to look at and you couldn't be, that part of you comes out of you. That's the part that you refuse to look at. King Solomon, it says, don't listen to sins, because the basic foundation of sin is murder. It's murder. That you murder somebody. That's no problem. I mean, they say in psychology, don't leave an older sibling with a younger sibling. I mean, because they can do harm to them. They really don't like them. They feel they've taken away the love of their parents, and so they will kill them. And it's been many cases that way. We're talking about very young, 3 to 5 years old, right. That's correct. Other than that, they already have the social thing, where their conscience stops them and covers up this part of them. But however, yes, it's very young children. That really happens here. We're not denying that a person needs other people and they need a social life. The question is, where in the makeup of the human being, where does it fit? Is it a basic need, or the social is just the cover up? Or there's some other thing that you need social. I'm just saying, I'm not saying it's the only reason why you need social. Social could be just a cover-up of so that I don't have to get involved in my own emotions.
Therefore,
I'm not denying that they need social. My question is, why do they need social? What is the need for social? That's the question. And I'm not denying that people need a social life. The question is, where in the makeup of the human being does it come? Is it the basic foundation of the human being? Or that need is the top layer that just covers everything else, and that's the need? At what point is that need for social life? That's what I'm saying. According to King Solomon, the way he sets it up, I say that the basic foundation, he's saying, is egocentric, where another person doesn't matter. That's what he's saying. And then the top level is, I cover it up. Look, that's the license that everybody, why do people take license in their group? That's how they take license. That's the top part. That's not the basic foundation of all the drives. Okay? It's not one of the instincts of a human being, of the social. It's one of the top layers. It's part of the conscience part of the human being. I mean, if you have no conscience, you're just an animal. There is no social life. There has to be some conscience, some control, that we have a way of talking to each other. We have what's acceptable in different societies, what's acceptable, how to converse and how you talk. What's acceptable? So it's part of the conscience, not part of the animalistic part of the human being. Just to review what we had yesterday, the reason why it says sins and not sinners, because it's talking the nature of the sin and the depth. It's starting from the depths and working out to the more superficial. The depths is the human is egocentric to the point where he doesn't care about anybody else and he can harm anybody else. Then he moves up the ladder to an ego type of pleasure, namely money. Okay, that's an ego type of pleasure. And then he reaches the outer level where you need people to work with and to relate to. Okay, so the last stage is the conscience. The middle stage is ego type pleasures. Okay, so that's the and the other one is the first one is the animalistic part of the human being. Okay, that is what King Solomon is saying here, the different levels of the animalistic part. And if you give in to you start giving in to the animalistic, you will become a murderer. You can become a murderer. There's a Rashi that says that this is the way of the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. Tells you to do this today and then that tomorrow until you could worship idolatry. What does it mean? It means that even though once you allow yourself steps into the world of the unconscious, how low can you go is you just can't tell. And don't think you cannot become a murderer. You can become. Elisha, the prophet, one time told the person that there's going to be a conspiracy and you're going to become king and you're going to take children's heads and smack them against the wall and you're going to rip out the fetus from the mother's womb. And the guy said to Elisha, says, "What do you think, I'm an animal?" You see, he couldn't even believe that he could do such a thing. And then it happened. And so King Solomon is saying that the base foundation is you could do anything. Just allow freedom to that. And the way you go is you down to the basic emotions that that you could do anything. I like this question. That is that when you look around, most people we know do not live the life of rationale, and they just follow their personality, whatever happens. And yet somehow they do not become these terrible evil things that the Torah predicts that they're going to become. I mean, there's a lot of people that live emotionally. They don't worship idols. They don't go out and murder. They don't do their base emotions. So the question is, what are you scaring me? How many people do this that come to these really base things? Most people, I mean, they live normal lives, but they don't become this. Question is what's the difference between the person that he's talking about and the most people that we know that will not become this type of person? In other words, the question is what about what we talk about today's people, years ago people? The truth is people haven't changed. It's just society has changed. In other words, first of all, technology changed. But after technology, what also changes is what we're into, how much there's certain societies that were closer to their base instincts. There's certain, after Christianity, we were more repressed. So we're more into the guilt and shame and fear type of things. So the thing is that, that but whatever it is, this, most of the society lived a certain type of life. Every once in a while you find, like the time when the Nazis were all powerful in Germany, so the society became totally evil. You know, the whole society became like an evil society. You did evil things. But however, most of the time, people just live their lives and they do bad things, they do good things based on their personality. but they live within a certain framework. But they don't do these horrible things that we say that you're going to do, that if you give in to your emotions and you don't live the intellectual life, so we say these terrible things are going to happen. And yet you look around and you don't see it. So why is it that we're so afraid of it? Right. In other words, once again, the Torah seems to imply that if you live and give in to your emotions, you will become the worst possible type of human being. You live by your base emotions after a certain amount of time. The fact is I don't see it occurring that often. So the question is, my observation and what the Torah seems to be saying seems to be in contradiction. In other words, is the quantity of people that become that evil is, from what I could see in our society, I don't see it. The question is like this. Sometimes somebody gets so angry that he wants to kill somebody, and then he holds back and he says, no, I'm not going to kill him because it's not rational. I don't think most people think that way. I think what happens is... No, I don't think they say it's not good for me. I don't think they're irrational. I think most people, they have the desire to kill, but however their conscience, the way they were raised and the society they were raised in, their conscience protects them from, stops them. The conscience, the tools of the conscience is fear, shame, and guilt, and this stops you from actually carrying out murder. So the thing is that the fear of getting caught could stop you from murdering. But it's not a rational thing. It's not a thought-out thing. And that's why I see most people live that type of life. Most people live by their conscience, and they control their, except in the certain societies where the whole society becomes evil. But however, in a lot of societies, most people they're irrational, and they're evil insofar as their society allows them to be evil, but they are good insofar as their society tells them to feel guilty about the bad things, you see? So the question is that they can become this, but not many people do. In other words, I see a lot of people not become that evil because of their conscience. Because their society around them makes their conscience, and therefore they can't kill, they can't murder, some people can't steal, they can bypass robbing a bank, but they can't bypass the guilt of robbing a bank or fear of getting caught, but they might steal a soap or something from a hotel or motel. But the thing is that I won't call them. They're ignorant. They're not living by the world of justice and ideas. So I say they're ignorant. But however, they're not the worst evil person in the world. They never become the worst evil person in the world. The answer is that the most people never make a free will decision. The free will decision means that I must do something that is outside my personality, you see? In other words, whether for right or for wrong, I must go against my personality. Very rare, unless a person is, has real problems when he's born, but basically very rare is a person born a mass murderer. What happens is that he lives a certain life and then he takes certain steps that become evil. But some of those steps must be outside his personality. Or to do righteousness, again, you must do things that are outside your personality. The problem is most people do not make a free will decision because they don't have the guts. That's what really is. They don't have the guts to go out of their personality to go either to right or to left. They just live within their group. How many kids are afraid, if they do something different from the group, like the group won't accept them, they become very frightened. They won't be accepted by the group, even though they might have a desire. They're caught. They can't move outside their society, outside the framework of their personality. This is not a, this, most people are like that, and how far they'll go will be totally based on the society. Whether you accept superstition or don't accept superstition is, if you're born in Haiti, you'll be sticking pins in dolls. But if you're born in the United States, so then you look both ways before you cross the street, and if you get angry with somebody, you'll talk lush and hurry, you'll gossip about them, but you won't stick pin in dolls. So the thing is that's just the societal thing. You can't take any credit for that. You didn't do anything. On the contrary, you're a coward of moving outside your personality. The Russia, the wicked person, and the righteous person have to make decisions that are against their personality. So the thing is that most of Torah, if you look at Torah, most of Torah talk to the people that are making free will decisions, or trying to get you to make a free will decision by getting involved in the world of study. But most people will not do that. Most people are afraid of that. And they never get into that type of situation where they'll move outside their personality or outside their society. They just sway in the wind, you know, like things that are growing. The wheat that's growing, it blows this way or that way according to the wind. So does the, they have no control of themselves. These people, there's not any inner drive. Everything is based on the way they were raised and based on their society. They don't have a free will decision. The Torah talks to those people that have free will decisions and are going to move outside the realm of their personality. That is why most people do not have the... That's what you see in most societies. They're just guided by the societies. Okay? But the Torah talks to the person that's going to make a move one way or the other. So he advises the person to, he has to advise that you're going to go out of your, you're going to have a free will decision. You could go one way or the other. So to you I advise, I will show you the difference in lifestyles. But a person that can't get out of his personality, so that type of person is, you can't talk to them. I mean, we're talking to a person that has the ability, the guts, to make that decision. That's what it says. Ezehu gibar kovesh es yitzra. Who's a warrior? He who could deal with his yetzerah, which means that he could go outside his personality to do that which is right. That is what I think the Torah in general speaks to. If you notice, the Torah speaks in general not to mediocrity, but by mediocrity I mean people that do not make a decision. Most of the times they speak about Esav, about Haman, about these type of people that made a decision to go one way or the other. Okay, and then in verse 15, he says, my son, don't go with them. He introduces my son again, because this is the consequence of giving into those emotions. These are the consequences. And he says in verse 17, because... in other words, it's like free. The bait that's in the trap in the eyes of all birds. In other words, when the bird sees the bait, he doesn't notice the trap behind it, and he thinks the bait is there for free, that he gets it for free without any consequences. There's no payment. Alright? That is the metaphor, and the question is, what does the metaphor mean? There are 2 points in the metaphor. The first thing is that you have to notice when you get something in the physical world, what the side effects are or what the consequences are. Okay? What the benefits are and what the consequences are. Getting the bait is good, but however, the trap, being trapped, is no good. So you must evaluate the consequences. But the second point that he's bringing out, that the person doesn't see the consequences. The desire for the bait, whatever the desire is, closes off in his mind the consequences. You see? That is the nature of the Yetzirah, the evil inclination. In other words, there is a desire for the physical world, and you see the physical world, and that blinds off all the consequences to it. And therefore that's really why this is at the beginning of the book. It's an introduction. It's telling you that it needs a training. That's why the next verse he says, don't go with them. And then he says that they are going to ambush their own blood. They're really hiding for their own lives. In other words, they're in hiding like to ambush. But it's really themselves that they're ambushing. Why is it an ambush? Because they don't recognize the consequences. The consequences are close to them. And so therefore they ambush themselves. They're ambushing themselves because they blank out the consequences and they don't see it. And this is what this book is about. This book is about to make you aware of the consequences, and so that you should be guided in all your acts and all your pleasures, by which pleasures are really either the consequences are not bad or there are no consequences. And when the pleasures are really terrible consequences, you have to know these consequences. So that's what the second half of these psukim are talking about. First half tells the nature of the Yetzirah, and then the second half tells the consequences of giving into the Yetzirah, and therefore you must train yourself to be aware of the consequences. That does not come naturally. That comes with training. Okay, we're doing chapter 1. We're going from verse 20 to the end of the chapter. It's one subject. Okay, it says that wisdom outside it calls out. Toronto really sings out. In the streets it gives its voice. In the head of all the marketplaces, or with the people, it calls in the doorways of the gates and in the city. It says it speaks its words. Okay, all right. So the. So the thing is that the wisdom calls out. Question is, what does it mean, wisdom calls out? Some people want to say that it's talking about wisdom, God calls out, that God calls out, or that it's the Beis Medrash, the study of Torah. But the simple words seem to be wisdom somehow calls out in the streets. Okay, publicly, the wisdom is calling out. That's what the first two verses here are saying. Okay, now what is wisdom calling out? That's the rest of the chapter. Okay? The rest of the chapter will tell us what wisdom says. The first thing that wisdom says, how long will the Pesi love his foolishness and the late love his mockery? They desire their mockery. And the fool hates knowledge. The ksil hates knowledge. Okay? So he's talking about the three types of fools. There's the pesi, there's the late, and the ksil. And the first thing we have to do is define these three types of fools. The first person is a person that is that doesn't really have much ideas. Anything that he does have, he just sways in the wind from others. He's a simple person. He doesn't have he has no trained mind. He just goes by his emotions, but his emotions are just follows whatever comes into his mind. That's what he accepts as a true idea. Okay, whatever comes into his mind, whatever other people tell him, what he reads. I mean, without, there is no critical thought about it. That's the Pessy. Okay, that's the first one. He's the person that's totally naive about any thought or philosophy because he just accepts whatever he hears and he has no critical thought about it. The late, the one that mocks, is a person that has a certain amount of critical thought, but his critical thought only goes to break down. Okay? Well, says that he hates knowledge. He's the one that has a false philosophy, and he will stick by that false philosophy and not accept any type of truth. You see, he will not see any critical question against his philosophy. He just has a philosophy of life, but however, that philosophy is a false philosophy. It sounds like he's intelligent, but he really, a lot of people, if you listen to a lot of people, they have their philosophies of life. And when you really listen with the critical mind, you really see, I mean, this guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, this guy is just totally off, you see. But they really feel that they're chachamim, they're wise, and they have this knowledge, but they're not critical about their investigation, and that's why the Pot, the King Solomon says, he hates wisdom, because he sounds like he does want wisdom, because he talks philosophical ideas and he tells you about life and he'll give you philosophical ideas about life and how to live your life, but however, it's not critical, it's not thought out. So the first thing that wisdom calls out, according to our metaphor, wisdom calls out to these three fools and say, how long are you going to be a fool? And he says, and wisdom says, turn to my tachacha, to my guidance. Behold, I speak to you. My spirit speaks to you. I'll make known my words to you. In other words, you're able to see, a person can see. Wisdom is saying you can see the foolishness of these three fools. Okay? These three types of fools. You'll be able to see the foolishness, and the chapter will continue and tell you what you can see just from looking around. You can see you'll see the consequences of that type of life. So wisdom speaks to these three types of fools and says, because I called to you and you refused, I waved my hand at you like waving my hand to come on, to come to my wisdom. And you did not listen. And you refused all my advice, and you didn't accept my tochacha, again, my admonishments, the ideas of the consequences of your life. He says, also I, in your destruction, I will laugh, I will mock. When your fears come, in other words, when your destruction comes, I will mock you. Okay, the question is, what does the metaphor mean? I will mock you or laugh at you when you're destroyed. The answer is that, you see, the fools, they have a certain fantasy of life. They look at life based on their foolishness, and that's their reality, you see. And they see that their reality is the best reality, and they will have the whole life, they only see good in their whole life. They can't look around themselves to see any type of consequences in their life. They can't view the future. So reality says, like, your life is a joke. Your whole life is a fantasy. Because the catastrophe will come. That's the joke. It's not really a joke. It's a sad thing. But the fact is that from the point of view of reality, you're living a foolish life, and the consequences will show the foolishness of your life. That's why he says, I will laugh. In other words, your life is really a total fake-out. It's a total fake-out. In other words, I'll give you an example. A person falls in love, and he sees everything as wonderful, and he's going to have the best marriage, and he gets married. Of course, in a year or two, they're fighting. You understand? The fact is that, well, just look around. It happens to everybody. What is there any plan that you're different than anybody else in marriage? People raise kids and they have big problems. Why are you different? Everybody feels, I'm going to do it right. I remember when we were kids, we used to say, we're going to raise our kids differently. It doesn't happen. It doesn't happen. It's a fantasy. You just feel that somehow you're different. I mean, in the cases that I'm saying. But I mean, there's a total fantasy, and you look around, and you should be able to see that it's a fantasy. It's very obvious. It's all around you that there is a fantasy around you. You see? You just open your eyes. It's really very simple. You just look at people around you. You'll see the consequences of their lives. I mean, you see people go out to work. They have problems with the family. They have problems with the children. They're very wealthy. And so what do they have? And then they work until the day they die. For what? Who gets their money? What happens to their money? I mean, everybody does that. Nobody says, well, what am I doing? What am I killing myself for? For what? What is life all about? Nobody asks the question. Somehow they just get involved, and that's it. This is life. This is their life, and they have their philosophies, or they're just following the crowd, whatever it is. But the thing is, it's all around you. These things are constant. Why are you different? You ever ask the question, why are you different? Nobody asks that question. Somehow, I'm different. I'm not going to have these consequences. They don't even look at it. They're not even aware of things around them, what's happening. They only look at things through the eyes of the good. That's why it's a joke. That's really the joke. It's a joke. Their life is a joke. That's what wisdom is saying. Wisdom is saying, that's the essence of this chapter, that they're pointing out that if you do not accept wisdom, and wisdom is all around you, not even in the books. You don't need the books. All you have to do is open your eyes all around you and say, why am I different than anybody else? I mean, it seems to be I'm having a good life, I'm having a good time, I'm a teenager, and I'm running around. Okay, I have a few problems with here and there, but the future looks rosy. I mean, what are you talking about? Look around. I don't see the rosy picture in the once they become adults. I don't see it. And you see the consequences of their lives, and nobody asks the question, well, why shouldn't it happen to me? No, we just go along our merry way to, that's it. There are all these consequences. That's the joke. That's the joke. That's why wisdom laughs and mocks. Because you're living a life of a joke. It's not a realistic type of life. We're up to verse 27. So it says, when it comes to catastrophe and your fears and your troubles is it comes like a storm. When it comes upon you, the troubles, all your troubles, troubles and oppression come upon you. What does it mean, a storm? What do you mean it's a storm? To the fool, it's like a storm. To the person of wisdom, in other words, he sees it. He sees it coming. To the person that's a fool, it's out of nowhere it came, and suddenly it came. You're totally out of control. It's like a storm. You're totally out of control. That's what it means by a storm. By a storm, it means that it's out of control. You have no control anymore. You lost control, and it comes suddenly. Why is it sudden, and why is it out of control? Because you didn't prepare for it. You didn't prepare for it, and you're not aware of it. And you say, where did this come from? Where did this happen? How did it happen? The person of wisdom sees it all along, step by step. He sees the thing happening. He's aware of what's happening, step by step. That's the man of wisdom. But the man of foolishness, foolish person, it's like a storm. Where did it come from? I don't know. I don't have any control. Then in verse 28 says, then they will call me, but I will not answer. They will search for me. They will not find me. In other words, then they'll try and find an answer. People, when they're in trouble, suddenly ask questions. But the questions are irrelevant. They weren't trained how to think, how to question, how to deal with any given situation. And since they aren't prepared to deal with the situation, so when they try to deal with it, all they could deal with, they try to think it through, but all they could think it through is with their old emotions and their old philosophies and their old ideas. That's all they have. So they can't work it through it at all. That is verse 28. And this was because they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear God. What do you mean it did not choose to fear God? The fear of God in Mishlei means consequences, that you realize that there are consequences in the physical world. Okay, that's the fear of God. In other words, when God created the world, he created the world that it goes according to a certain system. You do not live by that system. If you live by your fantasy, you see, and you do not live by that system, so then... that is the fear of God, because God created the system. So if you do not live by that consequences, that is not fear of God. Now you chose not to fear God. And then he said, they did not desire my counsel, they spurned all my reproof. And 31 says, they will eat the fruit of their way and will be sated with their own schemes. Okay, in other words, the way they live their life, because of their life, they will destroy themselves. Their destruction to themselves. A lot of people, when they're in a catastrophe, they try to blame, they don't realize that they're the cause, because they never thought that way. They never thought about they're the cause, so they start blaming God, they start blaming their parents, they blame their friends, they blame everybody else. They didn't do anything wrong. Okay? But the thing is that that's when they're in the catastrophe, they really get the real destruction is themselves. They really cause their own destruction. They could follow the cause and effect of every step that they took, but they don't have the ability to analyze it, but you have to analyze it. See, it's really for the people that listen to wisdom, they analyze it and they'll be able to see every step, how it works. And when they, the other part is called denial, right? But however, when you're able to see how it works, you see, then you still realize to live by the world of Musa, of the world of Tachacha, of the world of ideas, of the consequences. Then it says, for the tranquility of the simpletons will kill them, and the contentment of fools will destroy them. You see, what does that mean? It means that their philosophy... See, it doesn't mention the late seer. It only mentions the Pesi and the Ksil. Why? Because those two have a philosophy of life. I mean, the Pesi gets it through others in a simple way. The Ksil works out ideas to prove his philosophy of life. It's more worked out. But it's still based on his foolishness. And they have, according to their philosophy, they will have a good life. Like we gave examples before. Like you say, yeah, I'm going to work at it. It's not going to happen to me. I'm going to do things differently. and you don't explain how it's different or why you're different. And so therefore, you think you're going to be content in your life and you're going to be satisfied in your life, but it's really not true. It's only for on the short trip, it's okay, you know what I mean, on the beginning. But when the consequences start coming in, you know what I mean, in 5, 10, 20 years after the way you've been living your life, and then the consequences really start coming of the type of life you're living, then you that's when it's all over with. Because what are you going to do? Change then? Start thinking then? You had the chance. You see? But they really think that they're really going to be content and happy. And that very idea that they think they're going to be content and happy kills them. Then he ends up, but he who listens to me, meaning wisdom, he who listens to wisdom will dwell securely and will be undisturbed by fear of evil. Because he will understand the consequences of his actions. He'll learn how to deal with all different situations to protect himself, which is basically the book of Mishlei. Alright, and we're doing chapter 2 of Mishlei, and it says, my son, if you accept my words and store them up. Store them up means that you never forget it. You store it means that you don't forget the words. And if you make your ear listen to wisdom and incline your heart to discernment. Okay? I just want to explain what it means store up. Store up doesn't necessarily mean remember, but it means, my understanding is that it means, it means that it becomes second nature that you think that way. It's not necessarily remembering each and every fact that you learn, even though that there is a benefit in that. There is a benefit in remembering, but the essence of Mishlei is that you think a certain way. Not that you remember this or that pasuk, but that you think in a certain way, and in life when you make decisions, you think in a certain way. That's what it means to store up. It means it becomes second nature to you. It's not a matter of remembering. Verse 2 again, if you make your ear listen to wisdom and incline your heart to discernment. If you call out to understanding and cry aloud to discernment. In other words, you don't have it yet, but you're going in that direction. That's what it means, calls out. You're going in the direction towards knowledge. Okay. Now, this is the essence of the parak, of the whole chapter. You seek it as you do silver, and search for it as for hidden treasures, then you will understand the fear of God and attain knowledge of the Lord. Well, there's the commentaries that say that you should listen, that it means listen to your teachers. It means how you go about receiving knowledge. In other words, the desire must be to get knowledge. How you receive your knowledge, you must start out from teachers, you must do reading. How you operate, how you gain your knowledge, that is what the commentaries are saying. That you must desire, you must want it. But to what extent must you want it? You must want it like a person that seeks silver and searches for hidden treasures. That is the level that you must have for searching for truth. It means that there has to be a commitment to knowledge. There has to be a commitment to knowledge. In the last chapter, we said that wisdom laughs and mocks when the catastrophes happen. Okay? Which means that when you live the life of a fool and you look at life incorrectly, you make decisions based on that incorrect view of life, so then there must be consequences, because you're not living in line with reality. There will be consequences, you see. Now, when you see that, then, in other words, you realize that without wisdom, when it's for sure, like it's so real to you, these ideas, these consequences, it reaches the point where you will make a commitment. In other words, when you start out, in the first verse, it says, if you take my words and my commandments, you hide with you. It first says, if you take my words, and then they call it a commandment. So the Malbim says that when you start out, it's advice. But then as you continue studying it and see the truth of these ideas, then it becomes a commandment. You see? So therefore, when it starts out as advice, so it's a nice idea, it's nice to have, and you think about it. But however, when you realize that you can't live without it, and the catastrophe if you try to live without it, then it becomes a commitment. You see? So the first step is to recognize the falseness of your view of life. And there's two ways of doing it. One is the Mishle approach, to show you the consequences of the consequences of your actions. Okay? If you live the incorrect life, it shows you the consequences. That's King Solomon's approach. There was also a man by the name of Plato. It's written in the Dialogues of Socrates. His approach was to show the contradictions in the false life, that it must lead to contradictions. And he showed contradictions in the life of the people that lived by their false view of life, by the incorrect value system, or their false view of life. So he showed contradictions in their lifestyle. Those are the two approaches where again and again you either see the consequences or you see the contradictions of their lifestyle. So slowly but surely, as you see that, then there becomes a commitment. You see, there becomes a commitment to the life of learning, because you really see that otherwise you're going to have a catastrophic life. You see the consequences. So then there becomes a commitment to learning. See, that's why we said that storing up is not doesn't mean remembering this or that fact, but it's constantly showing the first stage, the consequences or the contradictions of the false lifestyle that these people have, you see, until it becomes real to you. You see, that's storing up. It's not this or that fact that you remember. But you start seeing from every different angle, from every different aspect, the contradictions and consequences of the incorrect lifestyle. It starts affecting you, and you're able to look at life to recognize immediately the consequences and the contradictions of the incorrect lifestyle. That is that gives you the commitment. And that is really the essence of the introduction that a person must have to have a commitment to the life of learning. He must see the falseness of all other lifestyles before he can make that commitment. That's the only way to get that commitment, through knowledge. I mean, people have the commitment based on emotions, the way they're raised, for certain religious reasons. They have commitment. But knowledge, wisdom, calls out, like we learned in the last chapter, wisdom calls out to you. This is what it means, where you see around you in every place you go, wherever you go, wherever there are people making decisions, and you start seeing that the way they live their life, there's consequences and contradictions and unhappiness. And so when you find that, then you realize that you have to move away from that lifestyle to the correct lifestyle. The rest of the chapter will deal with, if you make that commitment, what is the lifestyle that you will have? We already said that there are two ideas when it talks about when they mention the fear of God, it could either mean consequences of your lifestyle, where you're living against either the laws of nature, or you're living against the ideas how God relates to us. So there's God's personal supervision. So if you see the consequences, that is fear. So therefore, that is what this book is about. There's another type of fear, which is awe. That's a result of studying about God, about in the book of Tillim or Psalms. There you find awe. So they're saying that without knowledge, you cannot have fear of God. Okay, that's what the Malbim says. Okay. That without knowledge you cannot have fear of God, and he quotes the Pirkei Avos, says without fear there is no wisdom, without wisdom there is no fear. Okay, that's in Pirkei Avos. It also says that a ignorant person cannot fear sin, and he cannot be a righteous person. Cannot be righteous. It also says in Pirkei Avos. So the thing is that there is no way that you can reach fear of God or awe of God without knowledge. The fear of God, the consequences of your actions, that's the fear of God, going against reality, will be consequences. So that is the book of Mishlei. The question is that it says that then you will understand the fear of God and attain knowledge of the Lord. So the thing is that first you need the consequences, which is fear of God, and then you attain knowledge of the Lord. Now, why can't I attain knowledge of God without the consequences? You could study about God. I mean, you could study Torah, and you could see ideas about God. Question is, why can't, and also it says, the Malbim seems to say, that you can't attain wisdom without this fear of God, which is a certain type of wisdom. So the question is, what is there in this that is an introduction to all of wisdom? What is the book of Mishlei dealing with that it's an introduction to all of wisdom? There are many people that study, that don't learn Mishlei, and they study about God, and they study to have sciences and studies, and they seem to make it, you know what I mean? Why do they need the book of Mishlei? Mishlei seems to imply that you need, and most of the commentaries seem to hold that you need Mishlei, and that's an introduction to all other wisdom. The question is, why do you need Mishlei as an introduction to all other wisdom? In other words, the study of God is very different than the study of consequences. The study of God is, you have to study different sciences, you have to study Hashgacha Pratis, how God's personal supervision works over you, what's your responsibility to God, what you have to be. Why do you need Mishlei? Why is that an introduction to our wisdom? It's a different subject. Subject of consequences. So if I undo the consequences, I won't suffer the consequences of my life. But he's saying another thing. He's saying one of the consequences is if you don't study Mishlei, you will not have knowledge of God. What does one thing have to do with the other? One seems to be decision about life, and one seems to be wisdom about God, knowledge of God. What does one thing have to do with the other? The answer is, since you have, if you study about God and you have a false view of life, then that view of life will affect your study of God. Because God himself, the relationship to God is a very emotional type of relationship. And when you start out, you must have that false view of God that, just like you have a false view of life, you have an incorrect view of God. Everybody must start out with that incorrect view of God, and you must change the way you look at life. at the way you look at everyday life, and when you change your value system, then you'll be able to look at God in a different light, in a correct light, based on your changed value system. And the first step is to change your value system about everyday life. Then you have to change your value system insofar as your view of life, and you have to base it on Torah ideas, on the ideas of Torah, and not on how you feel God is, but on the Torah ideas of God. That's why Mishlei is needed as an introduction to all of life, because the first step is to change your total value system, the way you look at life. Everything will change. Once you change the way you look at life, then how you look at God will also change. Based on, of course, the change now will be based on Torah and the Chachma and wisdom. Okay? I'd like to clarify the last point, and that is this. There is a certain framework in which you gain knowledge. There's certain people that you know that they're very smart, they have science, and they win prizes in science, and they're known as great scientists or mathematicians. Many times their framework, if you watch or you read about them, you see their framework is either to make money or to get glory. You see? They have because they're working with their old framework, even the knowledge which they get in their own framework. Their understanding of life has not changed. In other words, when they have knowledge, they might have knowledge, but it's no different than a donkey carrying books. Donkey doesn't gain anything from carrying books. The same thing with these people. They have wisdom, much greater wisdom than any of us have, but it doesn't affect their life at all. They have this knowledge, but it doesn't affect them personally. It doesn't have any meaning to them. They don't know how to view it and how to interpret it to get the ideas and the philosophy and the concepts and how to relate to it. They have an incorrect relationship to it. See? But once you change your value system from the incorrect value system to the value system of Mishlei, then you can relate to Torah and wisdom according to a realistic value system, and then you could see the value, what information to your personal life and how it affects you, the knowledge that you have, how it relates to you. You relate to knowledge differently. Therefore, you need the introduction of Mishlei before you can get the ultimate benefit of the sciences. Well, not you get no benefit from the sciences, you're still the same person, no different from the person that started out to the person that finished. Okay? Sometimes you see certain scientists that even though they did not have Mishlei, they're able to see certain ideas, how it affects them in a certain way, they're able to see it. Okay? But however, like for instance, like they say the highest level of humility is the profession of astronomy. You see, why is that? Because when you study astronomy day and night, you see the vastness of the universe, so then you feel, what can my accomplishment be? So there they were affected by science, but how much they're affected, and in other words, it does change their value system. Certain people are changed by science itself and by knowledge itself. Certain people are changed that way. Some people are partially changed that way. But we say they shouldn't take any chances, and you get involved in the world of Mishlei, which will open the world much, much clearer than if you didn't have it. And if you didn't have it, you still see you would see the wisdom that you do get to a much greater extent, where you would see it from a totally different perspective. And the question is that how far, if without Mishlei and science does affect you, can it go to the same extent if a person that's with Mishlei, a person that studied Mishlei, would science benefit him more than a person that his personality was changed by science and he didn't have Mishlei? Can he go to the same depths of a framework in which he relates to the wisdom? Can he reach the same level of framework than if he had Mishlei? I don't know. I leave that for the listener to have fun working it out. So yesterday we said that if you make a commitment, the same commitment that a person makes to making money, you make that commitment to Torah, then you will understand, you will have knowledge of the fear of the Lord, and you'll find knowledge of God. Okay, now the question is, I don't know if this is true, okay? There are certain people that, for instance, let's take a case, the person doesn't have a high enough IQ to understand these ideas. To understand Mishlei, you do not need you don't have to be a great genius. In other words, if you can learn Gemara or Tosfos, then you can, if you understand that, then you can understand practically anything in Mishlei. Okay? However, you have to have some level of IQ. Okay? That's the first thing. Secondly, there are different emotions which do not allow you to, there are different emotions that don't allow you, like for instance, you'll see certain people, like the way they think, the way they ask questions, or the way they answer, they can't think correctly. They make certain, they can't see, there are people that see things in an incorrect view. I mean, many times you'll see the way people ask questions or the way they express themselves. You see, they don't understand what's going on, that there's something wrong in the way they think, and they might not be able to get it. There's certain people that, even if they do see it, they don't let any knowledge affect them, and they just use knowledge just for glory or ideas, and that's it, but it doesn't affect their life at all. So the thing is, it's not real to them. So these people will never make it. And even though they make a commitment to learning, there are many people that learned all their lives and they never really saw the truth. So the question is, how does he guarantee? He says, then if you accept it like that, then you will understand the fear of the Lord. Okay? So if that is true, I mean, he's saying that it's 100%, and from the fact that I have, it doesn't seem to be 100%. Even if you have a commitment, you might not be able to see the true ideas. The question is, what do you mean by that he won't make it? They won't make it means that they will not change their value system based on the ideas of Torah. They will stick with their old value system. There are people that learn Torah, but they relate to Torah with their old value system. The Torah ideas did not affect their value system. In other words, there are two statements that contradict each other. One is the statement of King Solomon that he says, then if you make a commitment to learning, then you will find fear of the Lord. Fear of the Lord, we said, means that you will change your value system. There are people that are involved in learning and they learn for many, many years and they have not changed their value system, they have not changed their view, and they were not successful in learning. Okay? So the question is, the facts that I have seem to be different than the facts that King Solomon has, and that is our contradiction. In other words, if you don't learn the right study, or if you don't learn it in the correct way, or if you have emotions that it can't affect you, that your learning is just for pride, for being to have the image of a wise person, so then you might not make it. It's not necessarily you're going to make it. I think the answer lies and I think that's the it says in the beginning of the next verse, verse 6, it says, "Ki, because God gives wisdom, and from His mouth you will have understanding." Okay, you'll have understanding. Okay, so the thing is, he's saying because over there. Okay, I'm saying that with the because, he's answering this question. With the when he says because God gave wisdom, from His mouth, from God's mouth, comes knowledge and understanding. You see, that is the answer to this question. How does it answer the question? Okay. If we go back a little bit, there were two metaphors. One metaphor, if you remember, was the metaphor of the bird that sees the bait but doesn't see the trap behind it. That's one thing. In other words, that the person is blinded by his own emotions to the consequences of his actions, and he has to remove the blindfold. Second metaphor is that wisdom will laugh. Wisdom will laugh at you because you think you have a view of life that everything is going to be okay because everything is working out now. Then suddenly, without warning, life gives you a curveball. You get the consequences of your life, and your whole life is like a joke. It's not really funny, but the thing is, but the fact is, it's a distortion because life is not exactly the way you see it. So that's why it's like a joke. Okay, that's what we said before. Now we're saying, the thing is, there are two ways of making a commitment to learning. Some people make a commitment based on their emotions, their feelings. In other words, they want to be known as a wise person. They want to get glory. They want people to pat them on the back. They want to use their knowledge to make money. Okay? If you make a commitment to learning because of these emotional motives, then there's no guarantee you'll make it. So that's what we call lo lishma. Lo lishma is the incorrect view, the incorrect purpose of learning. You have an incorrect view of learning and what the value of learning is. Okay? There is no guarantee. That's the only way to start out, but the commitment cannot be based on that. The commitment must be based on that there is no other life. That the consequences of living the life of emotions is so catastrophic, and it will not lead to happiness. And you do not know what's going to happen. You can't see the consequences. You can't see the results of your actions. If you cannot see that any type of commitment that you make is not the commitment that will definitely bring you knowledge of God. Okay? The only commitment that will definitely bring about this result and to have the best life is when you recognize that there is no other life besides the life of wisdom. There cannot be another life besides the life of wisdom. That commitment, King Solomon guarantees. He says, then you will get the results, and the rest of the chapter tells you the benefits of the life of Torah, but he says, then you will have the fear of the Lord. How do we see it in the next verse in Pasuk Vav? Says, because God gave wisdom. What does it mean, God gave wisdom? God gives wisdom. It doesn't mean that God is like a miracle. It's not a magic show. It's not like a magical formula. When God created the world, He created the world based on systems. There is a system. And any study that you do, in any science, you look for the system. You don't look for the particulars are only there to help you. In other words, when a astronomer looks at stars, it's not because he's interested in the stars. He's interested only in the stars to understand the system. The particulars of the system is only there so that you could understand the whole system. You see, there is a system that King Solomon is talking about, that there is a system that could give you the best possible life that the world has to offer. But you must see it as a system. There is a system, and that is, the system is that if you make your commitment based on the fact that there is no other life, there's no other life, any other life would be a catastrophe, then you could make it. But if you are committed because of any other reason, whether it's a, whatever lo lishma, whatever incorrect motive you might have, there's no guarantee you'll make it. There's no guarantee. The only thing that we could guarantee is if your lo lishma, your incorrect motive, turns to reality. That is the correct motive, where reality itself guides you. Okay? So when you start out, you start seeing that these ideas are these are important ideas, but it's not a commitment. It's not a commitment. You just see it, and you formulate it in your own framework, and it's very nice, like it's nice advice. Like the Malvim says, it start out like, it's a good advice, it's a nice idea, I like it, it's fun to discuss it. But however, that's how it has to start out. But after a while, you see that this is the only way. There is a system here. And the system really does work. You must see that the system works. It must be clear to you that the system works. And once you see that the system works and you're committed to that system, that is the commitment that you will guarantee that you'll get all the benefits of the life of learning. What we have so far is that if you make a commitment to learning, and that commitment is based on your ideas, not an emotional, sometimes you have an emotional